I thought I was going to remember a girl I'd kissed years before in that very same lobby. But all I remembered was the imperishable stench of the moldy mat lingering there. Lobbies never age. We don't either, I thought. Oh, but we do age. We don't grow up.
I knew it would be like this, she said.
How like this?
I don't know.
Then a moment later,
again, she said.
Because I wasn't reacting fast enough, she pulled me toward her and, without holding back, kissed me with her mouth so open that I felt dazed. Her hands were pressed against both sides of my face until, totally unexpectedly, one of her hands cupped where I was getting hard. I knew he'd like me. We left my old building. We walked down the main stretch of street vendors who never seemed to go to sleep. There was ferment in the alleys, and I liked the festive crowds and the overbrimming restaurants and enoteche, each with its infrared heat lamps.
I love these narrow alleys by night, she said. I grew up here.
I held her in both arms and kissed her again. I loved knowing about her life. I told her I wanted to know everything.
Same here, she said.
Then a moment later, but there are things that you may not want to know. About me, that is, she added. The words she'd just spoken muffled the joy and warmth of the moment. What was she saying? I shouldn't tell you, but I must tell you something I've never, ever told anyone. Because I've never met the one person who wants me as I am. Or, rather, as I've become. And I want you to know it soon, because I'll be forced to hide it, even from you, if I don't let it out now. After this secret, I have nothing to hide.
Don't you have a secret like that?
A secret that is so burdensome that it becomes a wall that can't be taken down? I want mine down before we make love, she said. Of course I have a secret. We all do, I said. Each of us is like a moon that shows only a few facets to Earth, but never its full sphere. Most of us never meet those who'll understand our full, rounded self. I show people only that sliver of me I think they'll grasp. I show others other slices. But there's always a facet of darkness I keep to myself.
I want to know that facet of darkness. Tell it to me now, you first, because mine is far worse than anything you'll say.
Perhaps it helped that it was dark when we talked, and as we neared the Basilica of Santa Maria in Trastevere, I told her about Miss Marguta. You see, our first and only time was in a shabby, cheap hotel in London. We undressed as soon as the landlord showed us to our room. It was late afternoon. We embraced, kissed, embraced again, and were trying too hard. But we persisted, thinking that if desire was giving us the slip, it had done so momentarily and would soon return. But it did not. I was young and vigorous, so I was as baffled as she was. She tried many things, but they felt wrong. And I tried too, but I was not arousing her either. Something was off, and though we discussed what it might be, neither could tell the cause. By evening, we put our clothes back on and ambled about the streets of Bloomsbury like two lost souls, both pretending we were hungry and were looking for a place where we might find a bite. Instead, we drank a lot. When we returned to our room, nothing had changed between us. We did succeed eventually, but it was sex by mutual persistence, not desire. And to top everything, in the moment of alleged ecstasy, I ended up calling her by the name of the woman I was seeing at the time. I'm sure that each of us was relieved to find ourselves back in our respective homes in Rome 2 days later. She tried very, very hard to stay friends, but I avoided her cold-bloodedly.
perhaps because I couldn't face how I'd let her down. Or perhaps because I knew I'd sullied my friendship with both her and the man who would become her husband. Years later, when she was very sick and clearly dying, she tried a few times to get in touch with me, but I ducked her and never replied. I'll never, ever forget that. She listened, but said nothing. Would you like a gelato? I asked. I'd love one. We entered an ice cream shop. She ordered grapefruit, and I pistachio. It was clear she wanted to ask more about what I'd told her, but I wanted to hear her tale. Your turn, I said. Promise not to hate me afterward. I'll never hate you. As we walked out of the ice cream parlor, she said she just loved this. The way the day had turned out, the way we'd met, the reading, dinner, drinks, her father, and now this. It happened when I was 15, she started. My brother, who was 2 years older, had a friend over one afternoon, and they were watching TV in his bedroom. I joined them in my typically intrusive younger sister way, sat on the bed with them, as often happened when I didn't want to be alone in the living room, and we were watching peacefully when my brother put his arm around my shoulder, as he sometimes did. But then the other boy did the same. Gradually, the boy's hand moved from my shoulder to under my shirt, and my brother, probably feeling this was still innocent groping that was bound to end the moment I said something, touched my breasts more as a prank than anything else, or perhaps to highlight that there was nothing unusual or shocking in what we were doing. But I didn't object, and neither of them was stopping. Then the friend unzipped his pants, and it would still have been little more than naughty horseplay except that my brother, who probably didn't want to be upstaged, did the same. I acted as if the whole thing was natural, and then took it a step further and asked the two of them to lie next to me. All three of us huddled together, still watching TV. I trusted my brother and felt safe and knew he would never let this go the distance, except that I let the friend remove my jeans. The friend did not hesitate and right away was on top of me. He was done in seconds. But now comes the part I'll never live down. It seemed such a silly game that I told my brother it was his turn and even shamed him for hesitating, which was when I realized, and not before, that the whole thing with his friend was simply a ruse on my part. Because I wanted my brother, and I wanted him to make love to me. Not just fuck me, because it would have been the most natural thing between us. And perhaps this is what lovemaking is. Even his friend urged him on. I'd rather not. She's my sister. I'll never forget his words. He stood up, pulled up his jeans, and lay back down on the bed and continued watching TV. Ever since, my brother will never be alone in the same room with me, and when there's company, and we have to sit on the same sofa, he'll make sure to sit at the other end. We have never spoken about this, and to this day, I know it stands between us when we kiss hello or hug goodbye, which we avoid whenever possible. I know he's never forgiven himself or me, but it is I who've never forgiven him. I was offering him everything I was, because I worshipped my older brother. Shocked? Disgusted? No. She threw away what was left of her ice cream. I hate the cone part, she said. Then changing topics as we were nearing the hotel, she said, this is not about tonight only. Not for me either. Just saying, she said. I have to make a phone call. Don't you? I shook my head. What will you tell him? Who, my father? He's long asleep. Your boyfriend. I don't know. It doesn't matter. Is there absolutely no one you need to call? I looked at her. Hasn't been in a long time. Just making sure. Let's go to my hotel. She finished her phone call in less than 30 seconds. Hasty and perfunctory, I remarked.
Just like his sex.
He said he wasn't surprised. He shouldn't be.
That was it.
I told him no discussion. I liked no discussion. One day she'd use no discussion with me as well. As soon as we entered my hotel room, I caught sight of my duffel bag sitting on the luggage rack by a narrow desk. There was only one chair in the room.
I remembered packing my bag very early that morning in what suddenly seemed an entirely other lifetime.
I remembered its spot near the sofa in her father's home. The bellhop must have brought it up sometime in the afternoon and left it here. A quick look around told me the room was much smaller, even if I always ask for this one. So I apologized to Miranda and said that I liked this room every time I was in Rome because of the balcony. It's literally 7 times the size of the room. The view of Rome is amazing. So I opened the shutters and stepped out onto the balcony. She followed. It was nippy outside, but the view was like her father's. Stunning. All the domes of the Roman churches were aglow and had come into view. But the room still felt smaller than I remembered, and there was hardly any space to walk around the large bed. There wasn't even enough light in the room. Yet nothing bothered me. I loved it this way. I threw a sidelong glance at her. Nothing seemed to bother her. I wanted to hold her, and I came up with a singular idea. I was not going to undress just yet, nor was I going to tear her clothes off the way they do in the movies. I want to see you naked. I just want to see. Take off the t-shirt, the shirt, the jeans, the undies, the hiking boots.
Even the hiking boots and the socks? She quipped.
But she listened, offered no resistance, and proceeded to undress, until she was all naked, standing barefoot on the threadbare carpet that must have been at least 20 years old.
You like? She asked.
Since our room faced the courtyard and was exposed to all the other rooms in the hotel, I was worried that the other guests might see. But then let them. She didn't care either. And placing both hands behind the nape of her neck, she assumed a pose that showed off her breasts. They were not big, but they were firm. Now it's your turn. I hesitated. I don't want shame. I don't want secrets. Everything is out tonight. No shower, no brushing of teeth, no mouthwash, no deodorant, no anything. I've told you my deepest secret, and you've told me yours. By the time we're done, there mustn't be a living wedge between us. Or between us and the world. Because I want the world to know us for who we are together. Otherwise, there's no point, and I might as well go back to my daddy now.
Don't go back to your daddy.
I won't go back to my daddy, she said, as the two of us smiled, and then laughed. I tendered my left wrist to her, and she began helping remove my cufflinks. I hadn't asked her to do this, but she had guessed. I had a feeling she'd done it with other men. I didn't mind. When I was totally naked, I approached her and for the first time felt her skin, her entire body against mine. This is what I've always wanted. This and you. Then because she saw me hesitate, she took my right hand and placed it between her legs, saying,
"It's yours. I told you I don't want the shadow of anything between us. And no half measures. I make no promises, but I'll go all the way with you. Tell me you'll do the same. Tell me now, and don't take your hand off. If you're not ready to go all the way, you'll go back to Daddy." I know. Talking like this aroused me.
"Now just look at the lighthouse," she said.
I liked her name for it. I removed the duffel bag from the luggage rack, sat on the rack, and no sooner did I sit down than she came and sat on my lap and slowly allowed me to penetrate her.
"Better now?"
she said, as we held each other in a very tight embrace. I'll tell you anything you want to know. Anything. Don't move, though. And so saying, she squeezed me, which made me pull her even closer. She was teasing me and holding my head and staring straight at me as she'd done in the coffee shop, finally saying, "Just so you know, I have never in all my years been so close to anyone." "Have you?" she asked. "Not ever." Such a liar, and she squeezed me again. "You do this once more," I said, "and I won't focus on anything you say."
"What, this?"
"I warned you."
"She was just saying hello."
But unable to hold ourselves back, we began making love in earnest, eventually finding it more comfortable on the bed.
"This is all I have. This is all I am," she said.
Later, as we continued to make love, I caressed her face and smiled at her. "I'm holding back," I said. "Me too," she smiled. And after touching herself, brought her damp hand to my face, to my cheek, and my forehead. "I want you to smell of me." And she touched my lips, my tongue, my eyelids. And I kissed her deep in the mouth, which was a signal we both understood. For it was from time immemorial, the gift of one human to another human. "Where did they invent you?" I said, when we were resting. What I meant to say was I didn't know what life was before this. So I quoted Goethe again.
"I hope you enjoyed the show,"
she told the window, when a bit later she looked outside and saw that the shutters had stayed open. I shrugged my shoulders. Neither of us cared. I was about to move.
"Don't go yet. I want us to stay like this."
She looked to her left. Neither of us had noticed that a streetlight was shining red and green into our room.
"Film noirish," I said.
"Yes, except that I don't want this to turn into one of those Hollywood films where the sobered professor returns meek and chastened to the life he left behind. And all he shared with the anonymous lady on the train was a shallow little quiver that couldn't even pass for a heartthrob. Never." But she looked upset, and I thought there were tears welling in her eyes.
"Everything I have is yours."
"Not much, I know," she said. I let a palm rub the tears down from the side of her face. "Everything you have, I've never had. What more is there to want? The question should be, why am I what you want, when you can do so much better? Children, for instance?"
"Well, that's a no-brainer. I do want a child. But I want it from you and no one else. Even if we never see each other after this weekend or after the beach house or whatever, I think I must have definitely known outside Villa Albani, maybe even before."
"When?"
"Right after you almost kissed me but held back."
"I held back? Did you ever?" The thought of a child flooded over. "I want your child too. And I want it now." Then I caught myself, but I shouldn't presume.
"Presume, for God's sake!
I'm selfish enough to take everything you're offering."
"Can you do crazy, then?" she asked.
"Because I can."
"What do you mean by crazy?"
"To do in this lifetime everything you couldn't do in your humdrum, day-to-day, sterile other life. Do you want to do it with me, now?"
"Yes, but can you actually drop everything, your dad, your work?" I asked, almost aware that I sounded like someone looking for excuses to put off making a decision. "I have my two cameras. It's really all I need. The rest I'll buy anywhere."
She asked if I was sleepy. I wasn't. "Did I want to take a short walk?"
"Love to," I said. "Via Giulia when it's empty as a dreamland. There's a wine bar to the right at the very end."
"Shower?" I asked.
"Don't you dare," she said.
We got dressed quickly. She was wearing what she'd worn on the train,
I had brought a pair of chinos that I was only too happy to put on. Outside the hotel, the street was almost deserted. I love Phantom Rome when it's empty and looks like this.
Remind you of anything?
Not really. You?
No. And I don't want it to. We were holding hands.
What do you want your new life to be?
I didn't know what to say. I want it to be with you. If those we know won't have us the way we are, let's get rid of them. I want to read every book you've read, hear the music you love, go back to the places you know and see the world with your eyes, learn everything you cherish, start life with you. When you go to Thailand, I'll come along, and when I give a lecture or a reading, you'll be there in the last row, just as you were today, and don't ever disappear again. The world, according to you and me, are we spending the rest of our lives in a cocoon? Can we be this foolish?
Do you mean what happens when we wake up from this?
No idea. But I want to change so many things about myself.
Such as? She asked.
I had always wanted a leather jacket just like hers. And I always wanted clothes that didn't make me look like a Sunday-fied churchgoer who's removed his necktie on the way to the golf course. And I wanted to change my name to my nickname. And what did she think if I shaved my head or wore an earring? Above all, I wanted to stop writing history, maybe a novel.
Anything.
Let's never wake up from this.
We were walking up Via Giulia. She was right. It was deserted, and I loved the absolute silence and the glazed sheen on the San Pietrini at night, and the one or two streetlights that cast their exiguous orange spill over Rome. My son had told me once about Rome by night. I'd never seen it this way before.
So when did you know about me? She asked.
I told you already.
Then tell me again.
On the train. I noticed you right away. But I didn't want to look. The whole grumpy thing was a sham.
And you?
On the train, too.
There's a man who knows life, I thought. I didn't want us to stop talking.
Little did you know.
Little did I know I'd be walking down this street still wet with you.
The things you say. I smell of you all over. She reached over to my neck and licked it.
You do make me love who I am. Then on further thought, I hope the day never comes when you make me hate myself. Now tell me again when you knew about us.
There was also this other moment by the fish stand, I continued, when you kept pointing at the fish you wanted and craned your body forward, which was when I glimpsed your neck, your cheek, your ear, and caught myself wanting to caress every part of exposed skin from your breastbone up. I even thought of you naked making love to me. Then I pushed it away. What's the use, I thought.
So what's the nickname you want to be called by?
It's not Sammy, I said. Then I told her. No one had called me this since I was 9 or 10, except for old relatives and distant cousins, some of whom are still alive. When I write to them, I still sign my name that way. Otherwise, they wouldn't know who I was. After we were back, it would come to me in waves that night. This was still unreal. And there was nothing to compare it to. Unreal because I knew enough to fear such fevers never last. Unreal because it made everything around me feel equally frail. My life, my friends, my relatives, my work, myself. We were lying very close together.
One body, she said.
Except when we eat or go to the bathroom, I added.
Not even, she quipped.
And with each of us coiled into the other, with a thigh between the other's thighs, closing my eyes for a while, I began to see how this was
altogether different from how it had been with so many women I'd known in my life, and how our bodies themselves could be so ductile to everything we asked and sought of them, provided we asked and sought. What baffled me most, when I remembered the years of my life, was the distance we traveled to lock our doors after scarcely leaving them ajar on our very first night with a stranger. She was right about this. The more we know someone, the more we shut the doors between us. Not the other way around. "The thing that scares me," I began with my eyes still shut. "The thing that scares you?" she asked, already seeming to deride what I was about to tell her. "Of the two of us," I started, but she stopped me right away. "Don't say it, don't," she cried, suddenly releasing herself from my embrace and shoving a palm almost violently over my mouth. At first I wasn't sure, but moments later, even as I relished the swiftness of her gesture, I tasted blood in my mouth. "I'm so, so sorry. I didn't mean to hurt or to offend you," she exclaimed. "It's not that." "Then what is it?" So I told her there was blood in my mouth and that it reminded me of sparring with a schoolmate in kindergarten and tasting something strange in my mouth and knowing for the first time that it must be blood. "I like the taste because of you. It took me all the way back to beginnings." And suddenly I saw it. I'd been alone for ever so long, even when I thought I wasn't alone. And the taste of something as real as blood was far, far better than the taste of just nothing, of wasted and barren years. So many years. "Then hit me," she said all of a sudden. "Are you mad? I want you to hit me back." "What, so we're even?" "No, because I want you to slap me on the face." "What for?" "Just slap me, for God's sake, and stop asking so many questions. Haven't you ever slapped anyone before?" "No," I said, almost apologizing for not having hurt a fly, let alone another human being. "Then do this." And with these three words, she struck her cheek savagely with the flat of her hand. "This is how it's done. Now do it." I aped the gesture and gave her face a soft tap. "Harder, much, much harder, front and backhand." So I slapped her once, which startled her, but she straightaway turned the other cheek to indicate that I should slap the other as well, which I did, and she said again. "I don't like hurting people," I said. "Yes, but now we are as close as people who've lived 300 years together. It's your language too, whether you like it or not. You love the taste, I love it too. Now kiss me." She kissed me, and I kissed her. "Did I hurt you?" "Never mind. Did it make you hard?" "Yes." "Good." "My lighthouse," she gasped, reaching down my body and holding me firmly. "This is who we'll be, even when we're seen fully clothed and prettified in public. You inside me, all cum and juices."
"And don't fool yourself, this isn't honeymoon sex," she had said when we sat at the Enoteca that she'd meant to show me. We had found a table in the corner and ordered two glasses of red, then a plate of goat cheeses, and once done with the cheeses, a plate of cold cuts, and then two more glasses of wine. "This is how I want us always to be." 12 hours ago, we were complete strangers. I was a man drifting to sleep, and you were the lady with a lap dog. I looked around the place. I'd never been there before.
"Tell me something. Anything," she said.
"I love seeing Rome through your eyes. I want to come back here tomorrow night with you."
"Me too," she said.
Neither of us said another word. We were among the very last to leave before closing time. There were few hotel guests this time of year, and the personnel dressed in white jackets the next morning were busy confabulating and joking with one another while cheesy, loud music was playing in the background. "I hate background music, and I hate their yapping," she said, indicating the help.
She did not hesitate in turning around to one of the waiters who happened to be close by to ask if they could lower their voices. He was startled by the complaint, but did not answer or apologize. He simply cowered and walked back to where another waiter and two waitresses were standing, chuckling loudly. Right away, they got quiet. "I've grown to hate this hotel," I said, "but I come here each time I'm in Rome because of the balcony attached to my room. On warm days, I love sitting under the umbrella to read. Later in the evening, I have drinks with friends either on my balcony or in the larger terrace upstairs above the third floor. It's simply heavenly there." After breakfast, we crossed the bridge and were about to head toward the Aventine, but then changed our minds and came back along the Lungo Tevere. It was still early Saturday morning and Rome was very quiet. "There used to be a movie theater here. It closed ages ago. And there used to be a bric-a-brac shop hereabout somewhere. I bought a small backgammon set once, made in Syria, all inlaid mother-of-pearl mosaics. A friend borrowed it, then broke it or lost it. I never saw it again." She sought my hand, and we ambled near Campo dei Fiori. Nearby, the fish vendor was busy setting up. The wine store still hadn't opened. Felt like ages since we'd come here to buy fish. "We're spending the week here in Rome," she told her father when he opened the door to us. She had bought enough food to last him 3 weeks. "Nice," he stuttered, scarcely disguising his joy. "And what will the two of you be doing for a whole week?"
"Dunno. Eating, taking pictures, visiting, being together. Strolling," I added.
It was clear her father had understood we were lovers and wasn't shocked, or at least pretended not to be. You could read it on his face. "Yesterday you were strangers on a train and barely touching, and now you're fucking my daughter. Nice! She'll never change." "Where will you stay?" he asked Miranda.
"With him. It's 5 minutes away on foot from here, so you'll see me more than you've ever bargained for."
"And this is bad news?"
"It's great news. Can I leave the dog with you, though?"
"But what about your work?"
"All I need is my cameras. Plus, I'm tired of the Far East. Maybe I can discover parts of Rome or northern Italy through his eyes. Yesterday, we saw Villa Albani, which I'd never even seen before.
I also want to take her to see the archaeological museum in Naples. The statue of Dirce being tied to a bull by two brothers needs an expert's camera."
"When are we going to Naples?"
"If you want, tomorrow," I said.
"More train rides. Perfect."
She seemed truly overjoyed.
When Miranda left the room, her father took me aside.
"She's not all she's cracked up to be, you know. She's impulsive, and there's always a tempest brewing inside her head. But she is more delicate than the most friable china. Please be good to her, and be patient." There was nothing to say to this. I stared at her father, then smiled, and finally placed my hand on his. It was meant to reassure him, a gesture imparting warmth, silence, and friendship. I hoped it didn't seem patronizing. Lunch was quiet, mostly an extension of breakfast. Miranda made a large omelet. "How did he want his?" she asked.
"Plain," he said.
"Maybe some spices?" she asked. He liked spices.
"And not a dry omelet this time, please. Gennarina makes terrible omelets."
It had gotten warm, and we had lunch on the terrace again.
"And the walnuts," he said afterward.
"The walnuts, of course." She went back inside, took out the large bowl of walnuts, then stepped into the library, where she found the book she was looking for and said she'd read for 20 minutes. I had never read Chateaubriand, but on hearing her, determined that this is what I wanted for the rest of my life, every day, just after lunch, while sipping coffee, as we were doing now, if she wanted and wasn't busy, 20 minutes of this great Frenchman's prose would make my day. When we had drunk our coffee, her father did not accompany us to the door. Instead, he stayed on the terrace,
seated at his table, and watched us leave. It mustn't be easy for him, I said as she shut the door behind her. Actually, it's awful. And shutting this door behind me is always agony. On our way to Piazza di San Cosimato, she looked at the darkening sky and said, "Looks like rain soon. Let's go back." It was too early to head back to the hotel, so we strolled into a large housewares store. "Let's buy two identical mugs, one with your initials and one with mine," she said. She insisted on buying the mugs, mine with a large M, hers a large S, but she wasn't satisfied. "How about tattoos? I want you permanently inscribed on my body, like a watermark. I want a tiny lighthouse. How about you?" I thought for a moment. "A fig." "Tattoos, then? I know of a place," she said. I looked at her. Why am I not even hesitating? "Where on our bodies?" I asked.
"Next to, you know."
"Left or right?"
"Right."
"Right it is." She was silent for a moment.
"Is this going too fast for you?"
"I love that it is. Will it hurt?"
"I wouldn't know. I've never gotten a tattoo before, never even had my ears pierced. What I know is that I want our bodies never to be the same again."
"We'll sit and watch each other get tattoos," I said. "Then when I go to meet my maker and I am asked to get naked and expose myself and he sees this fig tattoo to the right of my junk, what do you think he'll say?"
"Professor, what's this next to your flibbertigibbet?"
"A tattoo," I'll say.
"A fig tattoo, is it?"
"Yes, Lord."
"And the reason for disfiguring the body that took 9 long months to make?"
"Passion is the reason."
"Yes, and?" he says.
"I wanted a sign carved on my body to show I wanted everything changed, starting with my body, because for once in my life I knew there'd be no regrets. Maybe it was also my way of marking my body with something that I always feared might otherwise vanish as easily as it breezed in. So I carved her symbol on me to remember. If you could tattoo my soul with her name, you should do it right now. You see, God, may I call you this? I was on the point of giving up, of living the life of someone who had accepted his sentence and cowering before his menial little lot. Living as if life were an extended waiting room far below room temperature, when suddenly here was this beautiful commutation. I know I'm using big words, but I trust you understand, Lord. And from the dark, silent, muddy, narrow shanty lane that was my life, it swelled into a huge mansion, facing a wide open field with beach views all around and large rooms with large flung open windows that never rattle and never shake or slam shut when a sea breeze wafts through the house that has never seen darkness since the day you lit the first match and knew that light was good.
So you're a comedian. What does God do then?
God lets me in, of course.
You're in, good man, he says.
But then I ask, pardon your lordship, but what good is heaven to me now?
Heaven is heaven. It doesn't get better than this. Have you any idea what people have given up to live here? Want to take a look at the alternative? I can show you. In fact, I can take you down there, show you where you could just as easily be skewered and roasted for having that piece of nonsense punctured you know where.
But you're pouting. Why?
Why, Lord, because I'm here and she's over there.
What, do you want her to die too? So that you can coddle and canoodle and have your little fun and slop in my kingdom?
I don't want her to die.
Are you jealous that she's likely to find someone else? Because find someone else she will.
I don't mind that either.
Then what, my good man?
It's that I would love one more hour, one measly hour in the million, trillion, bazillion hours of eternity to be with her, a tiny speck of nothing in the realm of unending time. It costs you nothing.
I just want to go back to that Friday night at our Enoteca, holding hands over the table as they keep serving us wine and cheese, as the place empties out while only lovers and very close friends stay behind. And all I want is a chance to tell her that what happened between us, if it lasted 24 hours, was worth the wait of untold light years that came before evolution even started, and are to follow after our dust is no longer even dust. Until that day, in a quadrillion years on some other planet in some distant constellation, a Sammy and a Miranda will happen again. I wish them my very best, but for now, good Lord, all I ask for is another hour.
But don't you see, he'll say.
What don't I see?
Don't you see that you already had your hour? And I didn't just give you an hour, I gave you 24 of them. Do you have any idea how difficult it was for me to let your organs do what they may normally fail to do once at your age, let alone twice?
Correction, three times it was, good Lord, three times. He pauses for a few seconds.
And besides, if I give you an hour now, you'll want a day. And if I give you a day, you'll want a year. I know your type.
Right now, God seems to have offered me more time. It's not official. And he'll deny it if I tell anyone but you. You'll love my home on the beach. Every day we'll take long walks in the countryside, swim and eat fruit, lots of fruit. We'll watch old movies and listen to music. I'll even play the piano for you in the small parlor and let you hear again and again that wonderful moment in Beethoven's sonata when suddenly the tempest subsides in the first movement and all you hear is the trickle patter of slow, very slow notes, and then silence before something like a storm erupts again. We'll be like Mira and Cinyrus, except Cinyrus won't try to kill his daughter for having slept with him, and she won't run away from her father's bed and turn into a tree. And if we're truly lucky, in 9 months, like Mira, you'll give birth to Adonis. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. And how long does this idol last? Do we need to know? No limits. The tattoo artist was booked for the day, so we dropped the idea. Instead, we ambled about until we decided to head back to the hotel. In our room, I cannot believe how beautiful you are. Tell me what you like about me. Is there anything? I asked.
I don't know.
If I could open your body and slip into it and sew you back from the inside, I would do it. So I could cradle your quiet dreams and let you dream mine. I'd be the rib that hasn't become me yet. Happy to hang on and, as you said, see the world with your eyes, not mine. And hear you echo my thoughts and think they're yours. She sat down on the bed and began unbuckling my belt. I haven't done this in a while. Then she unzipped my fly and took off her clothes and stared deep in my eyes with a gaze that said, if love had never existed on this planet, it was born in this tiny, rinky-dink, so-called boutique hotel bedroom, facing a narrow street and so many windows where people are welcome to look in. Kiss me now, she said, reminding me how lucky I was to see this raw, savage, unkempt, gritty moment suddenly in my life. After our long kiss, she looked at me with something verging on defiance. Now you know, she said. Do you believe me? She finally asked. I've given you everything I have, and what I haven't given means nothing, just nothing. The question is, what more will I have to give next week? And will you even want it? Then give me less. I'll accept a half or a quarter or an eighth. Shall I go on?
A while later,
I can't go back to my life. And I don't want you to go back to yours, Sammy. The only good memory I have of my father's home is of you in it. I want to go back to that moment when you held my hands as I was fixing your collar and I kept thinking, this man likes me. He does like me. Why doesn't he kiss me then?
Instead, I watched you struggle until you finally touched my forehead, like a child. And then I thought, he thinks I'm too young.
No, I'm too old. That's what I thought.
You're such a fool. She stood up and removed the paper wrapping around each mug. They're lovely.
I have the house, you have the mugs, the rest is just details. Every day at lunch we'll eat the same frugal foods. Tomatoes cut into quarters, with country bread I love to bake, basil, fresh olive oil, a can of sardines, unless you broil a fish for us, eggplants from the garden, and for dessert, fresh figs in late summer and persimmons in the fall, berries in wintertime, and whatever else grows on trees. Peaches, plums, and apricots.
I am so eager to play for you that short pianissimo from Beethoven's sonata. Let us spend our time this way until you grow bored and tired of me. And if before that you'll expect a child, we'll stay together until my time is up, and then we'll both know. And there will be no sorrow from me and none from you. Because you'll know, as I'll know, that whatever time you've given me, my entire life, from childhood, school years, university, my years as a professor, a writer, and all the rest that happened, was all leading up to you. And that's good enough for me.
Why?
Because you've made me love this, just this. I was never a big fan of planet Earth. And didn't set great store in this other thing called life. But the thought of eating tomatoes with salt and oil at lunch and drinking chilled white wine as we're sitting stark naked on our balcony basking in the early noonday sun watching the sea sends shivers down my spine this very moment. Then a thought crossed my mind. If I were 30 years old, would any of this have been more tempting?
None of it would have happened if you were 30 years old. You're not answering my question.
If you were my age, I'd pretend I was happy. I'd pretend I loved my career, your career, our life. But I'd be faking it, as I've been faking it with everyone I've known. My problem is discovering what not faking is. And this is difficult and scary for me. Because my bearings are always pitched to who I ought to be, not who I am. To what I should have, not to what I never knew I craved. To life as I found it, not to the life I've let myself think was only a dream. You're oxygen to me, and I've been living off methane.
We lay on top of the bedspread, which she said had probably never been washed.
Any idea how many people have lain on this? As naked and sweaty as we are now?
We laughed it off. Without saying anything, we showered for the first time since we'd met on the train and got dressed to meet Elio. Elio was standing by the entrance of the hotel. We hugged. Then after I released him, he noticed that the person standing next to me was not a stranger who happened to be stepping out of the hotel at the same time as I was. Miranda right away extended her arm and they shook hands.
I'm Miranda, she said.
Elio, he replied. They both smiled at each other.
I've heard so much about you, she said.
All he does is talk about you.
He laughed.
He exaggerates. There's so little to tell.
As we walked out of the pebbled courtyard, Elio gave me a discreetly quizzical look that meant,
who is she?
She intercepted the questioning glance. And said right away, I'm the person he slept with after picking me up on the train yesterday. He laughed, though slightly uncomfortably. Then she added, had you been waiting for him at Termini yesterday, I wouldn't be standing here telling you this.
She immediately took her camera and asked us to stand by the gate.
I want to do this, she said.
She's a photographer, I explained, almost by way of apology.
So, what should we do? Asked my son, who was a bit at a loss for how to proceed.
Miranda sized up the situation right away.
I know the two of you have your vigils to perform, so I don't want to intrude, she said,
emphasizing the word vigil to show that she was already familiar with our father-son lingo. But I can tag along, and I swear I won't utter a word.
Promise not to laugh at us, though, he said, because we are ridiculous.
It was the way we walked, together yet not together, that allowed a touch of awkwardness to stand between us. I was trying to keep in step with her without letting him think that his place in my life was in any way altered or diminished by her presence. But then, a few steps farther, I caught myself walking much closer to him, almost on the verge of neglecting her. I was also worried that he might resent her presence and had wanted to talk about important personal matters. And perhaps he wasn't ready to meet her yet, and certainly not so suddenly. He must have noticed my discomfort and tactfully began walking ahead of us. I knew he was doing it on purpose, almost deferring to her, because we normally walked elbow to elbow. If there was tension between the three of us, his move helped diffuse it and restored the comradeship we felt while crossing the bridge together. We had spoken of going on foot to the Protestant cemetery, but it was cloudy and it was already getting late. The cemetery is perfect on a sunny, quiet weekday morning, I said, not a bustling Saturday afternoon. So we decided to repeat our walk on Via Giulia and headed to a cafe we all knew. On our way, I asked Elia what he'd played the night before, and he told us Mozart's E-flat major and D minor concerti with an orchestra from Ljubljana. He'd had to practice throughout the night before the concert and all during the day itself. But it had gone very well. He had to be in Naples for another concert Sunday afternoon.
So which vigil shall we start with today? Asked Miranda. Or will it be a surprise?
Once again, I worried that vigils were to be celebrated between us only, not with a third person.
So to lighten the mood, I told him that I'd cheated and had already done one vigil with Miranda.
The third floor apartment on Roma Libera, where I'd lived as a young teacher.
The chick with the oranges, he asked.
It made all three of us laugh.
Wasn't there another vigil on Via Marguta? Asked Miranda.
Yes, but let's not do her today.
Actually, the cafe where we're headed is sort of vigil-y, said Elio.
Whose vigil, yours or Sammy's? She asked.
Well, we're not sure, I said. It started by being Elio's, but by dint of coming back here with him, it became mine too, and in the end, ours. So you could say that we've overwritten and lived each other's memories.
Which is why coming here means something more, something extra, for which even the professor in me has no words. And now, Miranda, you're in these vigils too.
See, this is what I love about him, she said, turning to Elio.
The way his mind twists everything, as if life were made up of meaningless scraps of paper that turn into tiny origami models the moment he starts folding them.
Are you this way as well?
I'm his son, he nodded self-consciously. Cafe Sante Eustachio was so crowded that we were unable to find a table and decided to drink our coffees at the bar.
Elio added that in all the years he'd been coming here, he'd never once had a chance to sit down.
Tourists spend hours occupying all the seats, reading maps and guidebooks.
He insisted on treating.
While he slid between the throng of customers who were either waiting to order or to pay at the cashier, she sidled up to me and asked,
"Do you think I shocked him?"
"Not at all."
"Do you think he minds I'm barging in?"
"I can't see how. He's been pestering me to find someone after my divorce."
"And have you found someone?"
"I think I have. She said she'd stay with me."
Who's going to stay with you? Asked Elio, carrying a receipt and struggling to catch the attention of one of the men behind the espresso machines.
She is.
Have you told her what she's getting into?
No, she'll be horrified soon enough.
Seconds later, three cups were placed on the counter in front of us. I came here 3 years ago, trying to have a private vigil with a girl, and it was a disaster, said Elio.
How so? Asked Miranda.
Elio explained that as he was trying to experience her presence at the cafe as something meaningful, especially since the place already bore the imprint of other events in his life, they had an argument. She kept saying that there was nothing special about the kind of coffee they brewed here. He countered by saying that this was not about the coffee at all, but about being here to have the coffee. Their disagreement not only ruined the vigil, but made him hate her. They sipped their coffee as fast as they could and walked out in separate directions and never saw each other again. Yet quite a few years ago, here is where I had my first inkling of what my life as an artist, living among artists, would be like. My father and I come here each time he's in Rome.
And have your years as an artist been what you expected? Miranda said.
I'm superstitious, so I should watch what I say, he replied. But they've been very reassuring. My years as a pianist, that is. The rest, well, we don't discuss the rest.
And yet it's the rest I want to know about, I said, catching myself almost echoing Miranda's father.
At this point, Miranda recognized that the conversation was veering to the personal and excused herself to look for the bathroom. The rest, Dad, he went on, is a closed book these days. But the first time I came here, I was 17, and I was with people who read a lot, loved poetry, were deeply involved in cinema, and knew all there is to know about classical music. They inducted me into their clan, and every vacation I had from school, and later from university, I'd come to Rome to stay with them and just learn. I said nothing, but he caught the look in my eye. But more than my friendship with them, you, above everyone else, made me who I am today. We never had secrets, you and I. You know about me, and I know about you. In this, I consider myself the luckiest son on earth. You taught me how to love. How to love books, music, beautiful ideas, people, pleasure, even myself. Better yet, you taught me that we have one life only, and that time is always stacked against us. This much I know, young as I am. It's just that I forget the lesson sometimes.
Why are you telling me this? I asked.
Because I can see you now. Not as my father, but as a man in love. I've never seen you like this. It makes me very happy, almost envious to see you. You are so young suddenly. It must be love. If it hadn't occurred to me until then, I knew now that I was indeed the luckiest father alive. People were milling around us, some trying to wedge their way to the counter. None of them seemed to intrude on our intimate moment together. We were having a quiet fireside chat in one of Rome's most bustling cafes. Love is easy, I said. It's the courage to love and to trust that matters. And not all of us have both.
But what you may not know is that you taught me far more than I've taught you. These vigils, for instance, are perhaps nothing more than my desire to tread in your footsteps, to share with you anything and everything, and be in your life as I always want you to be in mine. I've taught you how to earmark moments where time stops, but these moments mean very little unless they're echoed in someone you love. Otherwise, they stay in you and either fester all through your life, or, if you're lucky, and very few are, you're able to pass them on in something called art, in your case, music. But above all, it was always your courage I envied. How you trusted your love for music,
and later your love for Oliver. At that moment, Miranda was back among us and put her arm around me.
I've never had that trust, either in my loves or, if you'd believe it, in my work, I continued.
But I found it almost inadvertently the moment this young lady invited me to lunch yesterday. Well, all I kept saying to her was, no, thank you, no, I couldn't possibly, no, no. But she didn't believe me, and she didn't let me coil back into my little conch. I was glad we'd spoken. As you said, we have never had secrets, you and I. I hope we never do. We left Saint Eustachio after quickly gulping our three sips of coffee each and were headed toward the Corso. So, where to next? Asked Miranda. I suppose Via Belsiana, I guessed, remembering that Elio and I always ended up at Via Belsiana to do what he called the if-love walk to a bookstore, in memory of a book of poems published 10 years earlier. No, not Via Belsiana today. I want to take you somewhere I've never taken you before. Is this recent, then? I asked, hoping he'd let me in on his latest romance. Not recent at all, but it marks a moment where, for a short while, I held my life in my hands and was never the same afterward. Sometimes I think that my life stopped here and will only restart here. He seemed absorbed in thought. I have no idea if Miranda is up for this, and perhaps neither are you, but we've confided enough already not to stop now. So let me take you there. It's just a 2-minute walk away. When we reached Via della Pace, I thought he was about to take us to one of my favorite churches in the area. Instead, no sooner had we sighted the church than he made a right turn and took us to Via Santa Maria dell'Anima. Then, after a few steps, and just as I'd done with Miranda the day before, he stopped at a corner where a very old lamp was built into a wall. I never told you this, Dad, but I was drunk out of my mind one night. I had just vomited by the statue of the Paschino and couldn't have been more dazed in my life. Yet here, as I leaned against this very wall, I knew, drunk as I was, that this, with Oliver holding me, was my life. That everything that had come beforehand with others was not even a rough sketch or the shadow of a draft of what was happening to me. And now, 10 years later, when I look at this wall under this old street lamp, I am back with him. And I swear to you, nothing has changed. In 30, 40, 50 years, I will feel no differently. I have met many women and more men in my life, but what is watermarked on this very wall overshadows everyone I've known. When I come to be here, I can be alone or with people, with you, for instance, but I am always with him. If I stood for an hour staring at this wall, I'd be with him for an hour. If I spoke to this wall, it would speak back. What would it say? Asked Miranda, totally taken in by the thought of Elio on the wall. What would it say? Simple. Look for me. Find me. And what do you say? I say the same thing. Look for me. Find me. And we're both happy. Now you know. Maybe what you need is less pride and more courage. Pride is the nickname we give fear. You were afraid of nothing once. What happened? You're wrong about my courage, he said. I've never even had the courage to call him, to write to him, much less to visit him. All I can do when I'm alone is whisper his name in the dark. But then I laugh at myself. I just pray I'll never whisper it when I'm with someone else. Miranda and I were quiet. She went up to him and kissed him on the cheek. There was nothing to say. Whispering someone's name happened to me only once, but I think it marked me for life, I said,
turning to Miranda, who right away understood.
In his case, but can I tell him? She asked me.
I nodded.
In his case, he whispered another woman's name to the woman he was sleeping with, said Miranda.
What weird families we all belong to. There was nothing to add. Minutes later, we decided to head off for a glass of wine at Sergetto's. We arrived just as the Enoteca was opening and had our choice of tables, so we sat where we'd sat the night before.
See, I caught the vigil bug as well, said Miranda.
I liked that not all the lights were lit, and that the place was dim, which made it seem later than it was. The man at the bar recognized us right away and asked if we wanted the same red. I asked Elio if a Barbaresco was good for him as well. He nodded, then reminded us that this evening he was driving back to Naples with a friend. He had come all the way to Rome to see me.
What kind of a friend? I asked.
A friend with a car, he answered, miming a dry look and shaking his head, meaning I was totally on the wrong track. When the wine arrived, the waiter went back to the counter and brought some snacks.
On the house, he said.
Must be because I tipped him nicely last night. We were probably the very last to leave before they closed. We toasted one another's happiness.
You never know, we might come to tomorrow's concert after we go to the Archaeological Museum.
If we do go.
Please, please do. I'll have two tickets for you waiting at the box office.
Then he put on his sweater and stood up.
I will say one thing. You said it to me once years ago. Now it's my turn. I envy the two of you. Please don't ruin it. I was with the two people I cared for the most in the world. We kissed goodbye. Then I sat down again facing Miranda. I think I am extremely happy. Same here. We could do this for the rest of our lives. We could.
What's the first thing you want to do next week when we'll be at the beach, if the weather holds?
I want to take a taxi at the train station,
put on a bathing suit, climb down the rocks, and dive with you into the water.
I left my bathing suit in Florence.
There are plenty in the house.
Better yet, we'll swim in the nude.
In November?
In November, the water's still warm.
Cadenza.
You're blushing, he said.
No, I'm not.
He gave an amused, disbelieving glance from across the table.
Are you sure?
I thought for a few seconds, then gave in.
I guess I am, aren't I?
I was young enough to hate being read so easily, especially during an awkward silence with someone who was close to twice my age. But I was sufficiently grown up to welcome having a blush say something I was reluctant to disclose.
Then I looked at him.
You're blushing too, I said.
I know.
This was about 2 hours later. I'd met him during intermission at a chamber music concert at the Church of Saint-Dieu on the right bank. It was an early November Sunday, not chilly but not warm, just your basic overcast autumnal evening that starts too early and presages the long winter months to come. Many in the audience were already seated inside the church and were wearing gloves. Others hadn't removed their coats. Yet despite the chill, there was something snug in the air as people quietly made their way down the pews, clearly in anticipation of the music. It was my first time inside this church, and I had chosen a seat in the very back in case the playing wasn't to my liking and I wanted to leave without disturbing anyone. I was curious to hear what might be the very last performance of the Florian Quartet. The youngest member must have been in his late 70s. They played regularly in that church, but I had never heard them live before and knew them only from their rare out-of-print recorded music and a few performances on the web. They had just finished playing a Haydn quartet and after intermission were going to play Beethoven's C-sharp minor. Unlike the others in church, and there were no more than 40 or so,
in attendance that Sunday. I was a latecomer and had bought my ticket from one of the nuns seated at the small table by the entrance. Almost everyone else had gotten theirs by mail and entered the church holding large vouchers, which they'd been asked to keep unfolded while a hunched elderly nun dutifully copied everyone's full name with an old green fountain pen. She was at least 80 years old and must have been doing this for ages, probably with the same pen and in the same tremulous, archaic script. The small barcode numbers on the vouchers probably reflected the younger image that the church wanted to project to new parishioners. But the old nun was having a hard time recopying them before stamping each voucher. No one said anything about her slow pace, but there were a few indulgent smiles exchanged among those who hadn't had their vouchers validated. During the intermission, I was waiting in line by the entrance for mulled cider, which the same nun was now scrupulously dispensing into plastic cups with a ladle she was barely able to lift when it was full. Everyone donated much more than the €1 written on the paper sign on the bulletin board next to the large vat of hot cider. I was never a fan of mulled cider, but everyone else seemed to be, so I stood there. And when my turn came, I put €5 into her bowl, for which she thanked me profusely. The old nun was sharp. She could tell it was my first time in her church and asked if I'd enjoyed the Haydn. I uttered an enthusiastic yes. He had been standing in front of me in line, and after I paid for my cider, he simply turned around and asked, "Why is someone so young interested in the Florian Quartet? They are so old." Then perhaps realizing that the question had dropped from nowhere, he added, "The second violin must be in his 80s. The others are hardly any younger." He was tall, slim, elegantly put together, with a gray mane of hair that fringed the collar of his blue blazer. "I've been interested in the cellist, and I figure that as it's rumored they're traveling later this year before possibly disbanding, our paths might never cross again, so here I am. Doesn't someone your age have better things to do?" "Someone my age?" I asked, surprise and stung irony in my tone. A moment of silence hung awkwardly between us. He shrugged his shoulders, probably his way of apologizing without saying anything, and seemed about to turn and walk to the area by the two portals where people were smoking, others chatting and stretching their legs. "Feet always get cold inside a church," he said, as he turned around and headed to the door. It was a closing, throwaway sentence. Then, realizing I might have snubbed him with my tone, I asked, "Are you a fan of the Florian?" "Not really. I'm not even a fan of chamber music. But I know quite a bit about them, because my father loved classical music and subsidized their concerts in this church. And I've been doing the same now, though, frankly, I prefer jazz. But I come here because I used to tag along with him on Sunday evenings when I was young, and I still come every few weeks or so to sit and listen, and perhaps to imagine I'm with my father for a while. But I'm sure all this must seem a rather silly reason to sit and listen to their playing." "What instrument had his father played?" I asked. "The piano. My father never played at home, but on weekends when we'd stay in the country, he'd go to the other end of the house late at night, and from my bedroom upstairs, I'd hear the piano as though it were being played by a furtive waif who'd stop the moment he heard footsteps creaking on the floorboards. He never spoke about his playing, nor did my mother ever bring it up, and the best I learned to do in the morning was to say, 'I dreamed the piano was playing itself again.' I think he wished he'd continued as a professional pianist, just as I'm sure he'd wished I'd grow to love classical music. He was the type who seldom forced his views on others, much less spoke to total strangers, totally unlike his son, as I'm sure you've noticed," at which he chuckled. "He was too tactful to ask me to join him on Sundays for these concerts and was probably resigned to going alone, but my mother didn't want him out by himself at night, so she'd ask me to come with him.
Eventually, it became a habit.